Hi, I'm Claire Wright.
And I'm Eve Rees.
And we are historians. And if this introduction still sounds to you like a confession or an act of sharing our addictions, well, you're right. We're back to tell you about our addiction to the archives.
So welcome to season two of our podcast, Archive Fever, where each episode we conduct intimate conversations with writers, artists, curators, fellow historians, and other victims of the research bug.
We talk to these archive addicts about what kind of archives they use, how often they use them, when they got their first hit, and what is their funniest, saddest, or most illuminating experience in the archives.
And we ask the question, what madness is this?
Today on Archive Fever, we are totally thrilled and just a little bit starstruck to welcome author Helen Garner into the studio. Helen is, of course, a much-loved novelist, essayist, short story writer, screenwriter, and film critic. Her first book, Monkey Grip, was published in 1977, and she has since added 23 more titles to her name, including the long-form non-fiction works The First Stone, Jo Cinque's Consolation, and This House of Grief. Her latest book is Yellow Notebook, an edited collection of entries from diaries Helen kept between 1978 and 1987. Thanks for coming in, Helen.
Thank you for having me.
Helen, I might start by making a confession for you and letting listeners know that you were at first a bit reluctant to accept our invitation into Archives Anonymous. You didn't really see yourself as somebody who engages in archival research, but we were really dead keen to talk to you about diary keeping as a form of self-archiving and therefore publishing your diaries as a form of self-research. And so I'd like to start by asking you about that first part of that equation, the self-archiving. Can you tell us when you started keeping a diary and why?
I can't remember, so long ago. I think it was when I was a teenager. I'm the eldest of six children, and our house was full of activity and noise. And I was always wanting to get away by myself because I just wanted to read, basically. But I don't know, at some stage I must have picked up a notebook. I don't remember when it went back so far. So we're talking, you know, the early 50s probably.
Did you ever consider that you were creating a document that could later be read as a primary source, either by yourself or somebody else?
Never. It fills me with horror to think that anybody would get a hold of my diaries and read them without me standing at the gate. I mean, there's just no way that I would let that happen. The purpose of keeping a diary, as far as I'm concerned, is kind of psychically necessary, or it became so over the years. I found that it was a way of just keeping myself from going off the rails. But I also have used it, I realise now, looking back, because now that I'm pulling these published diaries together, I realise how much I was practising and teaching myself to write and using, you know, what Freud calls the day's residue, which is what he says is the material of dreams, but the day's residue is what I sit down to make a record of, and I've used that as raw material to practice writing on, so that my diaries from quite far back, they're not just scrappy notes. That's how I learned to put a sentence together and to put a paragraph together. And you know, I haven't had to rewrite the diaries in order to publish them. All I've done is massive cutting, removal of mortifying material. That's nobody else's business.
So in terms of the diaries as they stand now, that's how you created them, can I just get a sense of how many there are and what volume of space they take up? You know, when we talk about archives and collecting institution puts them on the shelf, they'll say 4 metres.
Oh, okay, yeah. Well, yes, I can tell you, because I've, before I started doing this, thinking that I would publish them, or I should say at this point that I burnt quite a lot of them. And when I say that to historians, they go quite white. And I understand now that, having been to the NLA a few times, which is a place of, to me, a kind of shrine of glory and beauty and seriousness, I realise how excruciating it is for people to think that things get burnt. Mm-hmm. But by the same token, I am very pleased that I burnt those diaries. I haven't regretted it for a single moment. And every day I think, I can't wait to burn these. I probably don't think I will. The diaries I burnt up to the point at which Volume 1, Yellow Notebook, starts. Before that, there might be a few scrappy little bits of paper in a box somewhere, but I burnt them.
So from the 50s till 78. So a couple of decades
roughly.
Worth
yep.
of.
Yep. Yep.
So how many are there extant?
Oh, okay. So in my room where I work at home, I've got various boxes which I bought at Kiki K. They have nice boxes with little labels on the front, little label boxes. And I guess there must be about 25 of those. So they're not a really huge amount. And in each of those boxes, I would fit, say, four or perhaps five A4 exercise books, often bound ones. Some of them are Spirex. But does that give you a bit of an idea?
It does. It's just the sort of nerdy detail that we like. Thank you, especially the little labels on the front of the boxes. And have you ever considered donating the diaries or other personal documents to a collecting institution? Will you do that? Have you done that already?
I don't know. I have. No, this might be more opposite to your theme, which is the kind of daily journals that I keep when I'm writing a long-form piece of journalism or nonfiction, whatever you want to call it. So I started doing this when I was trying to get the first stone together. I don't know if I thought why I thought it would be useful. I had a sense, an instinct that I should do this, which was that every day during the period that I was trying to work and collect the material for that book, if I kept a record of what happened each day, and this is separate from my personal diary, this is a kind of working journal. It's dated and it's got things pasted into it, like a newspaper, things that I came across or emails, exchanges I might have had, although that was before the days of email, now I can think of it. But now in more contemporary ones of those journals, there'd be a lot of material like that. And I found the enormous value of those journals. At the end of the day, I'd sit down and I'd write what happened today, who I met, any conversations I might have had, even if I'd kept notes of those conversations, which, you know, in a more kind of working way, I didn't find out how useful it was until later. I had an urge to make a note of the mood of the project as it went, my mood, my moments of determination, my moments of despair and rage, and my moments of shame and distress, and detailed descriptions of people that I might have met that day, what they looked like, what their room was like, how the mood in between us changed according to what I said and what they said, how they struck me as a person, that kind of material. They're a very rich account of my engagement with the material. That's what they are. And when I came to write the book, I'm still talking about the first stone because this is how I learned what these journals were. When I came to write the book, I found them invaluable as a kind of spine to the book. Whenever I'm invited to speak to nonfiction classes, I always tell people about this discovery. I'm sure I'm not the first person in the world who's discovered this, but I just kind of slogged my way to it ignorantly, and I found it, the richness of it still amazes me when I look back at those things. So that's the kind of work that I have in fact given to the National Library, all the papers and those journals around each of those three nonfiction big projects that I did. They're all in the National Library now with a heavy embargo on them. One reason why I love the National Library is because they understand that a writer like me needs to be protected. There were people who'd approached me in a hostile spirit, demanding that I should speak to them, accusing me of having done certain things and demanding access to the papers. And I would say, no, I don't want you to see them. You know, you can see them in 40 years or when I die, perhaps you can see them. There are people in here that I want to protect, and I'm one of those people. A couple of these people who approached the library got up on their hind legs and said to the library, how can you justify having paid money for these or given someone, the writer, a tax break for donating these? It's taxpayers' money. How can you justify they're not being open? And I said to the librarian who I was conducting this conversation with, I said, what did you say back? And she said, we told him we collect for the long term. And that's why I love the National Library of Australia, because they said that. Also, after the first stone came out, years after it came out and all the hoo-ha had died down, I thought, I met a woman at a party. She was someone who'd had something to do with Ormond College around about the time that I was trying to get the material together to write that book. And she said to me, oh, of course, I was the one who gave you a certain piece of information that you were looking for around that time. I said, oh, were you? I don't remember. And she said, yes, don't you remember? We had a coffee together and I gave you a certain piece of information. And I thought, I have no memory of this. And it kind of freaked me out because, you know, your cognitive decline is threatening. But anyway, I thought, I'm going to get on a plane and I'm going to go to Canberra and I'm going to go to the National Library and I'm going to say, could you let me look at this material? And of course they said, yes, yes, of course. And they put me in a room and they bring in this trolley. And in the trolley were all these boxes and folders of such beauty and delicacy of preservation that I just about burst into tears. I saw that some piece of shit paper that I had tossed into the box, somebody had put in a folder and put in a box. And I can't tell you how moved I was by this. I just wanted to cry with awe that this is the attitude that an institution like that has towards work that people do, and they treasure it. And at that moment, I just wanted to get down on my knees to thank them. To finish the story about the strange woman, or the woman's strange thing that she said to me, I looked up the date, I looked up my journal, I looked up the account. I thought, there it is. An account of this conversation that I had with her, and I had written it down in dialogue form, and I found that she had not given me that piece of information, that she had in fact told me that she knew it and declined to give it to me. So I thought, I will now worship at the shrine of this library forever, and I will worship at my own throne or shrine for having written it down and dated it. And just learning comes back to what you said, how to create an archive. Well, see, this would never have crossed my mind that that's what I was doing. But when I had to go and check a fact, and I thought my dim memory, my dim instinct of that fact was correct, I was just overjoyed, and I suddenly was filled with respect for the historians and the archivists. It's an art.
Helen, that story is so marvellous and it just fills me with joy because I actually tell my PhD students to keep what I call a thesis diary. Not that I ever did it myself, but partly I tell them to do it because I wish that I had, because those sorts of things do come up later, particularly from descendants of people that you've written about and people that you have dealt with. And so I've been telling my students this for years, and now I'm going to say, Helen Garner does it, and you should too.
Yeah. And furthermore, it's kind of fun to do. And every day you sit down, and I never found it to be a tedious task.
Did you set aside a time in your day?
No, I just, you know, as the day goes, I sit up in bed at night, and that's when I write in my personal diary. You look back on the day and you think, what happened today that's worth remembering that I might forget if I don't write it down, or that the detail might get lost? I always tell people, date everything. Put a date on it. When did you find out that fact? Write down where you found it out.
You're a natural historian, Helen. You're an instinctual historian.
I can't believe this, because when I was at uni, I failed history. I was hopeless. I had no idea. But it never occurred to me that I would have a part in creating an archive. And also, just if it takes a long time to collect, for example, the book about the Robert Farquharson trials, This House of Grief, I mean, I thought the first stone was traumatic, but this was traumatic in a way that it went on so long. It went on for 7 years, the hearings for that trial. Robert Farquharson, just for the purpose of this, in case people don't remember it, he's a man who was accused of having driven his three little sons into a dam. And he was found guilty of murdering them, and he's in jail now. So what I'm talking about, not just the trauma of the story itself, which was deeply horrifying, but its endlessness. I went to the committal hearing, then a year later was the first trial. I thought, right, now I can write the book. The following year there's an appeal. He gets a second trial. The following year there's a second trial. I go to the second trial. He is found guilty again. The following year he tries to appeal to the High Court. I have to wait for that hearing. It goes on for 7 years and I couldn't start writing until it was over. But because I was keeping these journals all this time, these process journals, I had the stuff. It was there.
Helen, I'm struck that you just emphasise the importance of dating everything in your diaries and your, you know, work journals, because one of the things that really leapt out to me about the Yellow Notebook is the absence of dates. I mean, there's dates for each year, but the individual entries within the year are not dated. I'm interested in what was the kind of rationale behind that decision?
I don't even know if I can answer that. It was kind of an instinctual thing because, you see, a lot of the entries, you will have noticed, are very small. I think to have dated them would have been cumbersome in the text. Did you find it a lack in the book? Would you have liked things to be kind of anchored more to a time? As a reader.
Yeah, I see what you mean, that because the entries were quite small, it could have been a bit jarring to constantly have dates. And one could often infer the time of year through your descriptions of
weather.
What was happening. the weather, whether it was Christmas and so on. I was often intrigued by the gap between certain entries, because you could sort of infer that it might have been the next day or the next week, but it wasn't always totally clear. And so I was sort of interested in that kind of temporal structure of the diary.
It's a very complex thing. I'm not quite sure how I arrived at the decision, but I do know somebody said to me recently, she said, I've just read your diary book. She said, it was like floating through a dream. And I thought, yes, I was glad. See, I didn't even want to give people names. I thought I could get away with not naming people. I had this crazy idea that I could use kind of Homeric epithets, because I wanted the whole thing to float a bit above the ground of literalness.
You kept some of those, like the law student.
Yeah, well, there's a few of them. Yeah, the biographer, and there's somebody called the married man, but he gets a name eventually. I realise now that that was quite ridiculous, because people would be frustrated and bored and they'd be thinking, wait a minute, is that the same curly-headed person that was mentioned 20 pages back? And then I agreed with the publisher's suggestion, the editor's suggestion, that I should just give people, you know, the recurring people who, if you're reading it like a novel, you'd need to know who they were, close people. I actually like the way that the book, or a bad word for it would be lurches from one mood to another, or and I'm thinking more like it drifts, or that there's suddenly a step down, or suddenly it takes off and flies away. I think some people might find that a pleasure to read and other people might find it frustrating. But I can't really answer your question about why I didn't date things.
Helen, you're a prodigious writer, and now we know about the research journals, that's even more of an output than I actually even realised. But one of the things that you're renowned for is your letters and your postcards to friends and lovers and other writers over the decades now. So the likely chance is that those are going to turn up in other famous people's archives somewhere. Does this prospect scare you?
Yeah, it frightens the shit out of me.
Pass or redact, or you certainly can't destroy them the way that you did your early diaries.
No, but the copyright is mine. The copyright of all letters remains with me. But I'll tell you another story that was a terribly enraging thing that happened that's to do with these matters. Years ago, it'd be 20 years ago now, Brenda Nile and a fellow writer whose name I've forgotten, they were putting together the Oxford Book of Australian Letters. And several people had letters from me. And one of them, for example, was Glenn Tomasetti, an old friend of mine. She had offered them to the book, a letter of mine, and I was fine with it, except that it made a disobliging remark about somebody I'm very fond of, and I didn't want to hurt that person. And I said, yeah, you can have that letter, but I want you to just take out that half sentence there. And the editor said, no, we're not editing any of the letters. They're all going to go. It's all or nothing. And I thought, okay, well, so that was that. But then it turned out a woman I'd once been close friends with at university, we never fell out or anything, we just, our lives went in different directions. She had found a box of letters of mine in some shed or other and had pulled one of them out. I think maybe she'd even taken the whole box and shown it to the editors, and they'd picked out a certain letter. And I then heard from my friend, and she said, I've already copied the letter and I've sent copies of it to everyone, every member of the family that are named or concerned, the brothers and sister of the person who the letter was written to, and they've all said it's okay with them if it goes into the book. And I went berserk. I can't think of a time in my life where I've ever been more insane with rage. I was speechless, and even thinking about it now, I'd just break into a sweat of fury. I feel like, how dare you do this without asking me? You can't publish, you can't, it's my copyright. You can't publish this letter without my permission. How dare you violate my privacy and the privacy of our former friendship by showing this letter to all these people without asking me first? And what was the point of doing that? So I reduced her to helpless tears on the phone. Then I got onto the editors and I said, how can this possibly have happened? And they wrote back and said, oh, we're sorry you feel this way about it. And I blasted the shit out of them. I said, what do you mean? I mean, all this was in letters, in a slightly more controlled tone. But I said, this is not about yours being sorry about how I feel about something. It's about your unprofessional handling of a private document. Then they apologised very sincerely and I accepted their apology. And my friend, I thought, well, fuck you. Do not approach me again. Well, as it turned out, many years later, we met at a funeral and it was okay. But then there's a little postscript to this story. Just completely by chance, when the Oxford Book of Australian Letters came out, in which I was not represented, to my great disappointment, somebody sent it to me and said, would you want of this magazine I worked for, would you review this book? And I thought, now I'll get my pound of flesh.
Revenge.
Anyway, I pick up the book and it is wonderful. It is the most wonderful and superbly edited and curated. It's just a history of Australia and I adored it. And so I wrote a glowing review and I thought, I'm just forget it, that other shit, you know, okay, I didn't make it into the book. That meant that, you know, all feathers were smoothed and I lost my grievance. But I still do feel a great rage at what I felt was an act of betrayal and just stupidity by my former friend, that she could have, I mean, it would have never have occurred to me to do such a thing, to say, oh, hey, here's a letter about, you know, she's writing a letter about your brother who she was having an affair with at the time, and is it okay with you? Do you find it astonishing as an act?
Oh, yeah. I mean, just on a basic human, moral, ethical, and historically
outrageous.
That's right. Helen, it strikes me that you're clearly very passionate about your ability to control the way that your writing is used, but you are currently a living subject and content creator. One day, sadly, you won't be. And generally, as historians, we deal with dead people's letters and diaries. How do you feel about the prospect that in 100 or 150 years, people will be looking back over your material and you will have no control over what they do with it?
Oh, I won't care because I'll be dead.
So you haven't got a sense of a legacy that you're protecting?
No, I feel that at a certain point, I'll just have to let it go. I don't think we'll all be here in 150 years anyway.
You've just done us out of a job.
No, but these aren't things that I take lightly. And I'm finding this more and more as I'm editing the diary for publication. There are things in there that I just would not say about other people because they'd be pointlessly hurtful and they'd be a betrayal of intimacy. But the nature of a diary, of course, is that it doesn't care because it's not written for publication.
But you haven't gone as far as, say, Manning Clark, who famously annotated his own personal papers, going back over them once he had become the famous historian and writing margin notes to future historians and potential biographers. Can you imagine going back and curating your own archive that way now?
No. I love Manning. Manning was very, very good to me. He was a great support and a sort of a loving, almost paternal figure. I mean, you know, I don't think he thought of it like that, but he, over the years, gave me great encouragement and I have a very passionate gratitude to him. But I don't think I would ever do that. I'd be embarrassed to do that. I think that's a real man thing to do. I like to think that I could let it go and let it sail out there. But then, of course, I've got to worry about my daughter and my grandchildren, and are they going to die of embarrassment? Well, you know, life is what it is, and that's something that I've learned from editing these. Actually, this was quite a wonderful discovery to me as I worked my way through the diaries that I have used in book one of Yellow Notebook. I spent many mortified hours at 2 o'clock in the morning thinking, how can I do this? The ex will never forgive me letting these things become public. But somehow at the same time, over the period, I suppose it took me a year and a half or so to pull that book together, and over that period I went on living and I went on having relationships with people and I went on reading and seeing movies and TV and thinking about people and how they live. And as the time went on, I started having this wonderful feeling of comradeliness. I thought, everyone's a fuck up. Everybody is cruel and everybody is hurt, and we stagger through life ignorantly hurting each other and trying to bear the hurt that is done to us. And I had this incredible sense of comradeliness with the rest of the human race, and that's been a wonderful thing. Just right near the end, where I was putting the book together, I stumbled on that quote from Primo Levi that I've used as an epigraph at the beginning of that book from the periodic table. And I'm not sure if I'll get the quote exactly right, but basically he says, we are here for this. Oh, you've got it there?
I do.
Read it out.
So the quote is, because I've got your book in front of me here, we are here for this, to make mistakes and to correct ourselves, to stand the blows and hand them out.
That sums up my attitude to life, basically. To make mistakes, to correct ourselves, that's the very important part that a lot of people leave out. I think it's terribly important for people to clean up after themselves in every way. You know, you've got to bear the blows and you've got to hand them out, because that's what life is.
Helen, you've spoken about the kind of somewhat challenging emotional journey of going back to edit your diaries for publication. I'm also interested in how that process kind of interacted with your memory of those years. Did you find that you sort of had one memory of those years and then you went back to the diaries and you found quite a different narrative, or were the two pretty much the same?
That's interesting. No, I found they weren't grotesquely different. Mm. I do know that memory rewrites the past, and that's something that I've found particularly in those working journals, that I was very glad that I had them, because when I went back to conversations that I'd had with people I was writing about, I'd sometimes find that I had either attributed to myself some brilliant insight that another person had made, or I had misunderstood something, grasped for a meaning of something, and I'd jotted it down, but then seeing it in the light of everything that had happened subsequently, I'd go back and look at it, and I'd think, oh, but he didn't mean that. He meant a slight shade of difference. There was a fair amount of that in the diaries. I suppose what I found was, you know how your idea of your own history is that it moves through phases and a long, painful thing that you thought, like up to a year. You know, I thought I suffered in the year 1979 or whatever year it was. And you go back and you thought, oh, here I was going to the baths and cracking jokes and getting drunk and vomiting on the way home from the pub and dancing all night. I'd forgotten that bit. You sort of cast a sort of melodramatic gloom over certain parts of your life. And then you get back there and find that it was really much more differentiated and various. And you also have in your life certain criminals, as it were, people who you felt committed crimes against you in your personal life, and you go back and find, oh, but wait on, ooh, I treated him so badly, and look, here's evidence of it, my unfaithfulness, I hurt him deeply, no wonder he was angry with me, you know, that kind of thing. So memory tends to smooth over your own crimes. Mm. So if you've written them down, you know, that's correcting yourself to go back and read. I mean, correct yourself in that Primo Levi sort of way, to pull yourself back into line and think, no, I'm not such a perfect victim. I was a bitch.
So it sounds like you're saying that the process of going back and editing the diaries is almost an ethical act.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
That's very true. It's a terrific ethical challenge. You know, it's in your face. There's the stuff. You wrote it down yourself and you can't wriggle out of it. And I guess this is true about archives in general, but putting the diary together, the whole thing is composed of voice. It's a voice talking. It's my voice. But there's no voice over. If you're publishing a diary, you can't get to a certain point where you look really bad and say, well, I did that back then, but of course I'd never do that now because I've turned myself into a better person. You cannot let yourself off any hooks. There are certain things in there that make me shrivel to think about with shame, but I thought, well, I'll put them in. And I've been very happy to find that people say, this could have been my life. And that is a great joy to me because I know that I'm not unique.
Helen, that thing about people feeling attached to the diaries and the fact that they can see themselves in it as well, and I certainly felt that way. And I think all people must be attracted to certain entries where they see themselves or read themselves into it. There was one particular entry from 1985 I found really intriguing, and you write this, I still have a secret life in my mind, but who doesn't? And it only troubles me when I'm in a mood to trouble myself. I'll use anything that's available at such times. Going back to the diaries, researching yourself, were you looking for clues that you couldn't find? Did you come up against the brick wall of your own unknowable psyche, your secret self? And would you characterise that as a dead end, the way that historians, when they're in the archives, they just know when they get to the limits of the archive on a given question? They know they're either going to find the answer or they're not.
That's really interesting. I was quite shocked by things that I found about myself. It's not that I didn't know them, it's just that they baldly existed on the page and I was obliged to come to terms with them. There are things that I think I will never understand about myself, yes. One of them is recently I've been reading some of my backlist for audiobooks out of Belinda Books, and when I read Monkey Group, I was horrified by, I'll observe the fantasy that Nora is a character, but I was horrified. Nora's passivity in the relationship with her drug-addicted boyfriend, it was more than passivity, it was a masochistic relationship. So I'm sitting in the booth at the audio recording studio and I'm reading this stuff and I just couldn't believe it because I hadn't gone back and looked at that book for 30, 40 years. I just couldn't stand it. And I'm reading it out loud and I was dying of horror and shame and I'm trying to sort of read on in a, you know, reasonable tone. And once the guy was changing the CD and I said, oh, George, look, I'm terribly sorry. This is ghastly. And he said, what are you talking about? It's great. And I thought, oh, well, maybe everybody understands that sort of masochistic love that you can feel for somebody who is just really. I tried to sort of feel my way through the fog of it in the way that you're talking about in your question, I think. I think it was being drawn to a really dark self-destruction, that somebody was going to hell and taking themselves to hell and going absolutely into the black darkness often some people don't ever come out of. And it was as if I wanted to be near that process. I didn't want to do it myself. I didn't have the urge to do it myself, but I was very drawn to it and I wanted to be near it while it was happening. And that made me feel slightly less horrified.
I guess this process of self-discovery is something that we associate more with psychoanalysis rather than historical research necessarily.
And yet why do people want to read and read and read about Hitler? Or why do they want to read and read and read about the Holocaust? Why? It must be something to do with that kind of terrific attraction of ultimate destruction and darkness. And we don't want to go there ourselves, but we're sort of drawn to it.
And it takes a clear-eyed forensic view to go back and find that in yourself in something like the diaries. But that's exactly what you're most well known for in terms of your nonfiction, particularly in terms of the court procedurals. Do you feel like that's a skill that you developed from spending what must have been hours and hours and hours with court transcripts?
Yes. When I first started going to court, I mean, I knew nothing. I got no legal training. I didn't know journalistic training. I didn't know anything. I just wanted to go to court. And during the trial of the woman who murdered Joe Chinque, back then I didn't know how to get a hold of the transcript, and so I just approached the DPP in Canberra, and they kindly said, oh, we'll give you a desk, come into the office, and they just gave me the material, and I sat down with it and worked on it there. But then later I needed to get a copy of it, and I had to pay $500 or something. Transcripts are quite expensive, or they used to be. I was in the Geelong Magistrates Court at the Farquharson Committal, and one of the journalists kindly came up to me and said, have you put your name on the list? I said, what list? She said, there's a list of people who get the transcript emailed to them every day, free. And I thought, where is this list? So you just have to ask the judge's associate. So, you know, I said, I want to write about this. So then I had the transcript. This is the trap. I had the transcript every day. I'd get home from the court and there it would be. So I'd print it and I'd put it in a folder. And I had like 20 folders or more. And I was in love with that transcript. I was bewitched by it.
Sounds like you've got archive fever.
Yeah, well, see, I that was the first time I ever grasped it. I always think of an archive as being something you have to go into a building to find and make a fool of yourself by not knowing the Dewey Decimal System, all that kind of stuff. So there it was. And the first draft that I wrote of the Farquharson book was written in the thrall of the transcript. And I just looked at it and I thought, oh, God, the joy of this. It's all in here and everything everyone said is here and I'm going to find the truth. Is this archive fever?
Yes.
Yeah. And I was
We're
just
giving you an official diagnosis.
I was sort of in love with it. So what I did was I just transferred great hunks and lumps of it into what I was writing. And so I'd show somebody what I was writing, which I don't usually do until I'm right near the end because it's too embarrassing. And they would go, oh, God, it's really boring, Helen. One friend of mine who's a legal academic in the United States, she said to me, Hel, it's meant to be a story. And I had completely lost all sense of the fact that you've got to digest what you learn. And then you've got to write it again in your own words and you can quote from it. This was a very mortifying discovery to me. I was just thrilled, for example, by when the judge in the first Farquharson trial was instructing the jury. He said, okay, on the first day, he said, now you're going to be taken down to the dam where the children died. You're going to go down there tomorrow in a bus. Wear good shoes because there might be mud. And I thought, oh, I can't wait to put that in my story. And I put that in. People go, what the fuck have you put that in for? I go, but it's so kind. You know, he was being kind to them. And they're saying, hell, it's a story? Okay. So I had to fight my way through this forest and jungle of material. There are little treasures hiding in there among the undergrowth. And you just have to dig them out. And you've got to realize what's the treasure and what is the surrounding boring setting.
The historian Greg Denning described it in a first year lecture that I had with him as a iceberg, that's what historical research was like. So the tip of the iceberg, the bit that sits above the level of the water, is all that anybody will ever see of all that marvellous detail and research and all of those bits and pieces that you want to pull out and you want to tell people about. All of them have to sit below the surface and no one will ever see them. And it was great advice because it was both incredibly depressing but also unbelievably true. We all know the iceberg syndrome.
Yes, completely. I think many beginning historians deal with it by packing their footnotes with extra examples, but you know.
Footnotes, oh yeah.
But it's interesting, Hel, because you once said in an interview that writing novels was like, and I'm quoting you here, trying to make a patchwork quilt look seamless. Mm. A novel is made up of scraps of our own lives and bits of other people's lives and things we think in the middle of the night and whole notebooks full of randomly collected details. Now, I read that and I thought, this sounds awfully like the process of writing history. And it made me wonder, can you ever imagine yourself writing a legal procedural like This House of Grief or Joe Chinque based on the archives and reports of an historical court case, say a 19th century murder or an 18th century rape? Is that something you're attracted to at all?
No, and I'll tell you why, because I need to see the thing, I need to see the people, the true sense of the word. I'm not really a novelist. I think I'm really a non-fiction writer. I've never created a novel out of whatever people create novels out of. I mean, I just feel awestruck in the face of them, although I do know that novels aren't pulled out of thin air. No, I couldn't do that. I wouldn't be able to do it. I wouldn't be drawn to do it. I need to go to the place and have a look at the people, and I need it to be near me in some way. History to me is, I've always been hopeless at it and really bad at remembering things or the order in which things happened. And that doesn't mean I'm not interested in things that happened a long time ago, but no, I could never do that.
But think of all those beautiful manila folders and the nicely bound and all the labels on them in the shrine of the NLA.
Yeah.
Waiting for you to come and be in that place.
Silent song. I'm too old now. I'm too old to change, I think.
Helen, I wanted to return to this question of sort of self-discovery through returning to your own archive. You spoke earlier how your daily sort of diary practice was a kind of way of you practicing the art of writing. So you could sort of say that the, you know, diaries that you published a selection from are kind of an archive of your development as a writer in a way. So in going back to edit and kind of curate those diaries, did you learn anything new about you as a writer? Did you see new kind of patterns or trends emerge or sort of get a sense of improvement over time or?
Yeah, the main thing that I saw
was
that I, and that's one reason why I burnt a lot of stuff up until the point at which this volume, because up until then the diary wasn't about anything except me. And I was sort of disgusted and bored by it, and so I burnt it. But there came a point where around about the time after I came back from living in Paris, or when I was living in Paris, where I was quite homesick and unhappy, it was around about there that the diary started to look outwards. And as the years have gone on, there's more of that. There's, you know, I would spend an hour writing about some people I saw on a tram, nothing to do with me, strangers to me. I just got more interested in watching people and using what I could see, and kind of that became more sort of vitally interesting to me.
Mm. And were there also changes in your sort of, I suppose, on a more technical level, like on the way you constructed sentences over time? Do you see your writing changing in that sense?
I had this teacher at school called Mrs. Dunkley, and she was very ferocious about grammar and syntax, and I was given a very strong grounding in those things when I was a girl, and I loved them. And that was what I loved most about my schooling, was grammar and syntax, basically, in three languages. I mean, in English, I also learnt French and German. So I've always had a very strong love of a good sentence, and so I've always wanted to write well, you know, I mean, I don't want to throw a sentence together that's all creaky at the joints and saggy. I can see that as I've got older, I can put a longer sentence together harmoniously, and I know how to throw around subordinate clauses and how to. But there were certain points in my life when I can see, I noticed this more with my published books than the diary, where I seem to get an ambition to write more formally. And I enjoyed that very much. And so those are things that I practice. I don't think today I'll write long sentences. I just start writing and I think, oh, yeah, I'll just keep going with this and I'll add another couple of, you know, I don't think I'll add a subordinate clause, but that's what I'm doing. And just flexing my muscles in a longer, slower kind of way. And I can see that developing in the diary. I never was a crude or primitive writer because Mrs. Dunkley taught me how to do it properly, and I bless her name forever.
Mm, we all need a Mrs. Dunkley in our lives.
She was an awful monster, but she taught me she taught me everything I know.
Helen, now that we know that you're a secret, if somewhat reluctant, archive addict, we'll ask you a couple of questions that we ask at the end of all of our interviews to round things out. Was there something going back to the diaries that you would consider the sort of the funniest or the saddest or the silliest thing you found there?
Let's think. Yes, the saddest of some of the things I, my neglect of my mother, my impatience with my mother. My cruelty to my mother, I think cruelty might be overstating it slightly, but just yesterday I came upon this little incident with my mother, and it filled me with shame and grief. I didn't love her enough, and she was afraid of me. That's something that emerges in the diaries in a way that actually grieves me, and she's dead now, of course, and so is my dad, but I would have liked to be less the smart-ass intellectual around my mother. And, you know, I kind of, you know, to be perfectly frank, I thought that I despised her. And I find that so disgusting about myself and so shameful. But it kind of helps to confess it because I know that other people have, I think that's the clever daughter's problem.
Yeah, I was just about to say, I think that a few of us could be accused of that one.
In my generation too, our mothers, a lot of us had mothers who'd never studied, who never read, whose life was very, very bound by wifeliness. And suddenly up sprouts some daughter who goes to uni and thinks she's the aunt's pants and comes home all full of scorn and contempt. And, oh, God, I die of shame when I think about that.
You might have already given us the answer to this question, but it is one that we do ask all of our guests. And do you have a dirty little archive secret? And I've got to say, for listeners who haven't heard series one of Archive Fever, even I do confess our own in episode one.
The first thing that my mind leapt to when you said that was the day that I was in the Office of Public Prosecutions in Canberra reading the Joe Cinque trial. And they just dumped all this material on a desk and went away. And I was sitting there in a sort of an open plan office with this stuff in front of me. And I came upon a little Kodak, you know, sort of folder of photos. And I opened it up and in there were the crime scene photos. And I was very, very shocked by them. I'm not that they were all that particularly gruesome because Joe Cinque died of an overdose and it's not that there were like wounds and blood and things like that, but just this picture of this young man, a lovely looking young Italian guy lying on his back. And the only way you could know he was dead was there was this trickle of black muck that just ran out the corner of his mouth down to his neck. I looked at that for a long time and I don't know now. I can't believe that I would have stolen that photo. And I don't remember ever seeing it afterwards. But maybe I just fantasized stealing it. I would have thought that it would be a crime to steal it. And it would have been a crime against Maria Cinque, not a crime against the Office of Public Prosecutions. I felt that that was the treasure of the whole research that I was doing into that archive, and it was handed to me. They didn't probably even think that they'd given me the crime scene photos. It wouldn't have occurred to me to ask for them because I was so naive, I didn't even know there were such things as crime scene photos. But that photo is something that if I had been less timid or less morally decent, I would have stolen that photo and I would have treasured it forever.
Helen, thank you so much for coming and speaking to us today. It's been an absolute treat and you've been incredibly generous.
Thank you. I've enjoyed myself.
Thank you so much to Helen Garner for coming into Archives Anonymous to chat with us today. To learn more about Helen's work, you can look at her author page on the Text Publishing website.
So until next time, I'm Claire Wright.
And I'm Eve Rees. And you've been listening to Archive Fever, a La Trobe University podcast recorded and produced by Matt Smith on Wurundjeri land. Wurundjeri sovereignty was never ceded, and we pay our respects to their elders past, present and emerging.
You can subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you choose to listen. Our theme music is by Poddington Bear, which you can hear more of at soundofpicture.com. And if you're new to our little nerd cult here, you can catch up on all the episodes of Archive Fever, plus a bunch of nerdy links and photos on our website, archivefeverpod.com.
And you can follow Claire on Twitter at Claire A. Wright or on Instagram at Claire Wright Historian.
And you can follow Eve on Twitter at Eve Rees.
Coming up on the next episode.
That word junk, it's like you think junk, I know what junk is. Junk is the stuff that you throw out in the weekly garbage. Junk is the stuff that you see at the tip in satellite terms. This means satellites that don't work anymore, their mission life has ended, so they might technically work, but no one is operating them or using their data. And we're getting an increasing number of those fragments as we put more stuff up there and more collisions occur.